No, you're the first Sofont of your kind I've seen, he said, turning around to look Thumper in the eye. We've got some Gambolts in the company, a couple of Cynthians, a Voltron, and all kinds and shapes of humans, of course. But you're the first, what'd you say your species was?
I'm a Lepoid from Taloon, said Thumper. I guess we look like some kind of old Earth animal called a rabbit. In basic, the sergeant called me things like bunny ears and cottontail. Do the sergeants here make fun of people and call them names?
Captain don't like that, said Gears. People do it anyway, but if they get too nasty, they can get in trouble. Mostly, it's just fun in between friends.
Lieutenant Armstrong was more aloof than Gears. Perhaps his confrontation with the hunting party had something to do with that. Still, the lieutenant's first reaction to Thumper had been a kind of shocked silence, and he had never really done much in the way of welcoming him to the company. Thumper wondered whether Armstrong was uncomfortable with non-humans, though Gears's mentioning that legionnaires of several other races belonged to the company seemed to rule that out. Well, unless Armstrong was his immediate superior, that seemed unlikely to be a problem. Thumper's train of thought came to an end as the hover jeep crossed into the Legion camp and came to a stop.
Well, here we are, said Gears.
He pointed toward a large woman sitting at a portable desk, shaded by an awning.
You'll need to report to First Sergeant Brandy, I guess. That's her over there. She'll tell you where to go and what to do.
Thanks, said Thumper, grabbing his duffel and jumping out of the hover jeep.
No problem, buddy, said the driver, and good luck.
He started the jeep back up and headed off. Thumper shouldered his duffel and began walking toward Brandy. He still had no idea what Omega Company held in store for him, but he was about to find out, and this time he was determined not to throw away his opportunities.
Chapter 9 Journal Number 695
My employer's single stroke of genius was his perception that running his Legion Company was, in principle, no different from running any other kind of business. Well, perhaps genius overstates the case, but certainly the discovery was something no one else in the military seems to have stumbled upon. This meant, among other things, identifying key personnel and making certain that their loyalty was secured by the most direct means. I am quite certain that my employer would have been unable to pass the admonition, "Thou shalt not muzzle the ox when he treadeth out the corn," let alone identify its source, but he showed a keen understanding of it in practice. This understanding was particularly evident in his handling of the supply sergeant, one Chocolate Harry.
Chocolate Harry yawned and looked around his office. Somewhere or another he'd put a catalogue of custom hovercycle parts, little things that might add the perfect finishing touch to his beloved hog. Where had he put it? He riffled through the top couple of inches of a stack of magazines and catalogues on his desk, then stood and went to one of the file cabinets. But the thought of dealing with the chaos he knew he'd find inside was almost enough to chill his enthusiasm. He kept meaning to set up his database engines to connect him to the major hovercycle supply houses, but it was too much like work. His hand went halfway to the handle of the most likely drawer, then he drew it back. Before he ordered up any new parts, he really needed to give the hog a bit of a ride to see just how it was running. It had been a few days. As good as Omega Company had been to him, he'd fallen in the habit of actually giving his job priority over his hobbies. The old Chocolate Harry would never have approved, but Captain Jester had made a very persuasive case for the advantages of taking care of Legion business. Very tangible benefits, as it happened. And the captain had no qualms about letting the non-coms have all their traditional prerogatives, including the little rake-offs Harry had become accustomed to. Still, it had been a few days since he'd revved up the bike. It wasn't good for it to sit idle. Harry turned his gaze out the window, to the semi-arid landscape beyond the Legion camp. It was a clear day, but not too hot, and there were miles of open territory out there just begging for somebody to cruise through them at full throttle. Harry shrugged.
"What the hell?" he said, and touched a button on his wrist communicator. "Yo, Double X. I'm taking a couple of hours off," he said. "Gotta check out the hog, give it a real shakedown. Anything comes up, you can handle it, or make it wait until I'm back. Got it?"
"Sure enough, C.H.,"
came the raspy voice of Harry's supply assistant.
"Got it covered. Have a good ride. See you in a couple."
Harry nodded. He knew he could trust Double X not to mess up too seriously if something complicated came up in his absence. He pushed the starter button on the hover unit and listened critically as the anti-grav units warmed up. Satisfied at the low purr, He mounted the bike and put on his helmet, then keyed the remote to open the supply dump's delivery bay door. It slid noiselessly open. Harry edged the throttle up a notch, put the propulsion module into slow forward setting, and edged the hog out the doorway into the late morning sunlight. A few legionnaires waved to the supply sergeant as he came into sight on the hovercycle. Chocolate Harry grinned and waved back, then rolled his left wrist slightly, revving the engine just enough to remind the onlookers of the hog's power. A quick motion of the right hand, and he was in gear, soaring off into the desert in search of whatever adventures awaited him. Well, to tell the truth, there weren't usually any adventures, but out in the open air, it felt as if the chances were a lot better than at his desk in the supply depot. At first, Harry took a familiar path, a broad, level swath where he could push the hovercycle close to its top speed without worrying about obstacles. He leaned forward, lowering his profile as the hog cut into the dry wind, enjoying the speed for its own sake. Out of the corner of his eye, he could spot small desert animals belatedly scurrying out of the way of this noisy intruder. He'd never seen any living thing much bigger than the palm of his hand. There was nothing larger than that in this part of the planet, according to the Zenobians. He came to a halt on a low rise, where he wheeled the bike around to get a look back toward the camp. The landscape around the Legion base was flat enough that even a slight hillock gave him a long view in all directions. Harry normally didn't spend a great deal of time admiring the view, however. In his opinion, the desert landscape was just so much worthless real estate. Not even the locals had much use for it, as evidenced by the fact that they'd given it to the Legion for a base. This time, though, there was something new in the picture. In the middle distance, just south of the Legion base, there was a green canopy, a tent of some sort, Harry realized. It only took a moment for him to remember the scuttlebutt he'd heard from the command office. Captain Jester had finally found out that all the support he'd gotten from his buddies in the State Department came with a hefty price tag, namely, giving a party of big-time politicos the run of the planet for hunting. Harry could have told him it was going to cost. In fact, he'd be surprised if this was the only payback in the deal. Of course, that was only part of the story. Visitors from off-planet wouldn't have all the stuff they needed to handle local conditions. Chocolate Harry was just sure they'd have to have all sorts of supplemental provisions and supplies. The right color camouflage to match the local landscape, for example. Harry had plenty of it. They'd probably want extra liquor and ammo and bait. Harry was sure he could get hold of all that, too. Harry smiled. This could be the best opportunity to come his way since he'd cornered the market on purple anti-robot cami. He revved his engine and started off toward the distant tent. Sushi found Flight Lieutenant Qual with a crew of his fellow Zenobians, working with a large device that had been the focus of their attention for the last several days. Exactly what its purpose was, Sushi had never learned. He assumed the captain had some general notion what the thing did and why the Zenobians were setting it up in the middle of a Legion camp.
"How's everything going, Qual?" said Sushi, walking up to the group. "Good to see you today."
"Oh, raw fish," said Qual, flashing the disconcerting smile that reminded everyone of his race's carnivorous proclivities. "The Sklurn is obstinate today, but a tightening of the Zorn modulator should resolve that issue, or so one hopes. Mechanical onerosities can be recalcitrant, even with a good crew."
"I know what you mean,"
said Sushi, surprised even as he said it that he did follow the Zenobian's general drift.
"In fact, that's sort of what I came to see you about."
"Ah! Does your species have its own Sklurns?"
The tip of Qual's tail began twitching. "We were not aware of it."
"Nope, we're Sklurnless, far as I know," said Sushi. "It's one of our own machines I want to check out. Your auto-translator has been giving us some flaky output lately, and I want to see if we could recalibrate it."
"Flaking outpost?"
Qual's eyes opened wider, and he stared at the miniature device hanging from a strap around his shoulder.
"I have not seen any signs of it."
"Well, there you go," said Sushi, grinning. "That's just the kind of thing I was talking about. The translator usually adjusts itself automatically, but it's not necessarily perfect. In your case, you were the first of your species to get one, and there must have been some glitches because we didn't have any previous samples of your language. Anyway, it's been doing subtle mistranslations, probably in both directions, for quite a while now. That could be dangerous in an emergency. Best to catch it before anybody's life depends on it."
"Oh-ho! I comprehend," said Qual. "To state the facts, I thought some of you humans were saying very strange things, but I attributed it to your extremely bizarre cultural attitudes. But if it is merely a mechanical delusion, correction would be a boon to both species. How do you intend to adjust the device?
Well, to do it right, I need some information on your language, said Sushi.
Ah, I am but a simple air warrior, said Flight Lieutenant Qual. The subtleties of semantics are beyond me. Perhaps you need a certified scholar of language.
Don't sell yourself short, said Sushi breezily. You have been speaking your native language since you were a kid.
Not so, said Flight Lieutenant Qual. Our people do not acquire language until they are nearly grown, and each finds his own way. And some ways are very strange indeed. But the better a Zenobian speaks, the greater rights and duties that one can achieve. Chief Potentary Korg is the great power that he is, because he is the most admired speaker on all the planet.
Sushi stared at Qual for a long moment, then shook his head.
If I didn't know you better, I'd think you were giving me the business. In fact, I'm still not sure you're not trying to pull the insulated fabric over my eyes.
It is a verity, said Qual, and the other Zenobians working with him, who had followed the conversation with apparent interest, flipped their tails from side to side, a gesture that the legionnaires had learned meant the same to the Zenobians as a nod to humans. Perhaps your translator problems arise from this feature of our language.
It sounds like a good recipe for problems, said Sushi. Do you mean that everyone speaks completely differently?
Oh, not completely so, said Qual. Careful guardians will expose the adolescents in their charge to the most admired speakers, hoping to influence their mode of speech. It works to some degree. I myself was made to listen to the speeches of Korg's predecessor, Grand Potentary Zarf. I believe that was a large factor in my rising to officer rank so quickly.
Amazing, said Sushi, shaking his head. So how do messages that have to reach a lot of people get sent? Do you have some kind of common language that everybody understands?
Oh, yes, said Qual. But it is curious that you ask, Rawfish. That is a language that everyone knows, but no one speaks.
What the... Sushi frowned. If nobody speaks it, how can you communicate in it?
Very easy, said Qual, and the other Zenobians again flipped their tails. It is a language for the eyes only, which we use to record knowledge that everyone must know. However a Zenobian speaks, he will have learned the written language first.
Wow, said Sushi. That's exactly the reverse of how humans do it, and, as far as I know, all other species in the Alliance, too. Let me get this straight. You're telling me that the written language has no spoken equivalent.
Oh, no, that is the beauty of it, said Qual. It has many equivalents, as there are different ways of speaking. Every Zenobian knows the meaning of a written message, but the way of rendering it into sound is left to the speaker's own choice. A matter of taste, I think you humans call it.
Uh-huh, said Sushi. Excuse me, Qual, but this has just boggled my mind. I'm going to go think about it over a drink or two and see whether I can make any sense of it. Do you mind if I come back later and ask you some more questions?
Oh, no, said Qual. It is invariably an amusement to talk to you, Rawfish.
Thanks, I think, said Sushi,
and he wandered off in search of his co-workers on the Zenobian language project. He already had a good idea where to find them.
All right. How does this look now? Said Ernie.
He stepped out into the center of a little hotel room so Lola could inspect him. She stood with her hands on her hips, inspecting the dress suit he wore.
You still look more like an out-of-shape bouncer than a high-stakes player, she muttered. To tell the truth, I don't think it's the suit that's the problem. It's you.
Hey, I am an out-of-shape bouncer, Ernie said brightly. It's been a few years since I worked the door anywhere, but don't go taking me for granted. I'm in better shape than it looks like, baby. You ought to know that.
It's not what I know that matters. It's what Victor Fool and his bodyguards think, said Lola, frowning. If they knew what I know, they wouldn't even let you in the casino. Forget about striking up a casual conversation with a gazillionaire. We're stuck with trying to make you look like somebody respectable. Are you sure you can't shave any closer?
Not unless you want my face to look like the insides of a watermelon, said Ernie. Hey, why don't you just put a dress on me and try to pass me off for a cocktail waitress? Maybe you'll go for that one.
Yeah, right. I'm stuck with the raw material I've got, said Lola. Besides, this is Lorelei. He can't expect all the people he meets, even the rich ones, to be from his own social class. I wonder if he'd believe you as a construction magnet, self-made from the ground up.
Forget it, said Ernie impatiently. If you wanted an actor, you should have hired somebody off a Tri-V stage. Now, do you have any other improvements on the scam? Are we going to get any real work done today?
Lola threw up her hands.
Oh, the hell with it, she said. You're right. We're not going to get anywhere if I spend all my time trying to get your act perfect. You'll go over to the casino, talk up Victor Fool, and see if you can figure out what he's up to, if anything at all. Keep an eye out for his son. He's the one they're paying us to snatch, and make sure the Legion guards don't get too suspicious. I may need you to go back there again, and I can't do that if they throw you out of the place as an unsavory character.
Yeah, yeah, and I won't scratch my ass in front of the marks neither, said Ernie, sullenly.
I'd settle for you using civilized grammar, said Lola.
She shook her head, then relaxed, and said,
All right, then. Try not to lose all your money, you big dumbbell. And call if you're going to be later than midnight getting back.
Ah, the old guy probably ain't even up that late, said Ernie.
Then he grinned and said,
I'll call, though. Wish me luck.
You'll need all you can get, you goofball,
said Lola, and gave him a punch on the biceps. Ernie just grinned more broadly and ambled out the door toward the bus line that would take him to the Fat Chance Casino. Lola watched the door close, then shrugged and went over to her computer. She couldn't do much about Ernie's part of the job besides sit and worry, but she could get to work on other parts of the plan. She sat down and began working. Before long, she'd even forgotten that she ought to be worried about Ernie. Chocolate Harry's hovercycle coasted down the slight incline into the camp and came to a halt outside the largest tent. There was nobody in sight.
Hey, hey, called the supply sergeant. Anybody home? The man you need to see is here to be seen. You want it? I got it. Come on out and let's talk turkey.
A bleary-eyed face appeared between the flaps of the tent.
Who the hell are you?
It said, staring at Harry's considerable bulk and his Black Legion uniform.
Chocolate Harry, Sergeant Chocolate Harry of Omega Company, the man in charge of supplies, which on this planet means the main man you need to know. You the dude that's buying for this outfit?
The face came out in front of the tent, accompanied by a beer-bellied body. The man looked around as if to make sure the two were alone, then said in a quiet voice,
Not for the whole outfit, but maybe for myself. I'd be interested in some military-grade guns and ammo, something that can knock over some of the big critters I hear tell they have on this planet. Knock 'em over, said Chocolate Harry, rubbing his hands together. No sweat, buddy. I can sell you the same weapon the locals use, guaranteed to cold cock anything that walks, runs, swims, or flies. How many are you going to want? Just enough for me, said the fellow, lowering his voice even further. One, with the ammo, enough for a couple weeks hunting. Can you do it? Like I said, no sweat, said the supply sergeant.
He wondered briefly why a hunting party would come to a distant world without the weapons it needed to do the job. Did they come from one of the worlds where private ownership of arms was banned?
See, it ain't any of my business, he said. But it's kind of funny you'd come all this way without any guns. Oh, hell, we got lots of guns, said the hunter. I'd just like to get something a little bit better than store-bought, for myself anyway. If the other boys want to get their own, that's their lookout.
Chocolate Harry wasn't quite convinced. What if they'd come to a world without a conveniently corrupt Legion supply sergeant? Would this fellow have settled for the store-bought? Or was he trying to obtain the military weapons for some purpose other than hunting? Then he shrugged it off. It really wasn't his business. If there was money to be had, that was all he cared about. He smiled and said,
It'll run you $1,500, though, and you gotta keep quiet about it. This is Legion issue, top-secret stuff. Word gets out I sold it to you. Both our asses are gonna be in the cooler for a long time. Price isn't a problem, said the fellow. By the way, Sarge, my name's L.P. Osho. And you don't have to worry about me passing along any secrets. I do lots of big government contracts, so I know how to zip the lip. I'd hope you'll do the same for me. I get the idea your boss don't like us playing with guns. He's the last dude I'm going to tell. Believe you me, Osho, said Chocolate Harry. Now, guns ain't the only thing I can put in your hands. You folks need any fancy food or drinks? I got real galactic bohemian from New Baltimore, in the bottle or in the keg. Or I got genuine Scotch whiskey from Aldebaran IV. They even got sheep to pee in the water, give it the old earth flavor. Or maybe you boys need some pills. Nah, we brought all that kind of stuff with us, said L.P. Osho. Maybe if we run low, good to know there's a local source for the better things in life. But say, you wouldn't know where I can find a good poker game, would you? The other boys can't play worth a damn, and I wouldn't mind that so much if they didn't know they can't play. which means they don't play. Unless it's for the kind of money I throw the guy who opens the door for me in a fancy restaurant. And that ain't hardly poker at all in my DB. A fella likes a little real action. Where's he supposed to go on this planet?
Chocolate Harry rubbed his chin.
Gee, I don't know. Most of the guys in Omega Company don't have those kind of bucks either, he said. We do have a little game every now and then, if you're looking for some action. Not a lot of money, you understand. The Legion doesn't pay all that much, not even the fellows like me who've been pulling our weight for a good long while. But if you and your buddies are interested in something a little livelier, maybe we could get a few of the guys to show up for a five-buck ante. That's the kind of stuff I like, said Osho. What do y'all play? Dealer's choice, said Harry. Mostly pretty tame stuff like Anaconda or Hold'em. Every now and then something a bit funkier like Aldebaran or Texas Chainsaw.
So, if a fella came in with a different game he didn't mind explaining the rules, you wouldn't have a problem with that.
Oh, no, not at all, said Chocolate Harry, grinning. Why don't I see how many of the boys I can scare up? Would tomorrow night be cool?
Very cool, said L.P. Osho with a predatory grin.
Chocolate Harry grinned right back at him, then revved the hover cycle and roared back toward the Legion base. After a few moments, Houston Opetter came out of one of the tents.
What the hell was that noise? He asked.
Legion Sergeant inviting us to play poker, said Osho.
Poker?
Opetter frowned.
Hey, I came here for hunting, not cards.
Sonny, this is the best kind of hunting there is, said Osho. Sucker hunting. Ha! And I think I just found me a big one.
He rubbed his hands together and smiled. A very nasty smile. First Sergeant Brandy hadn't seen the AEIOU team arrive, nor had she watched the hunter shuttle landing out in the desert. She'd been too busy with her squad of new legionnaires, none of them raw recruits anymore, but most of them still unseasoned by her lights. This morning's training exercise had gone all haywire, and now she had to figure out how to make it work tomorrow morning. It had started out simply enough. She'd broken the squad into two groups, then sent one of them into the desert to prepare an ambush, and, after a decent interval, sent the other to try to find them without falling into the ambush. The spirit of competition should have spurred them to do their best, and in the process, both groups should have learned a good bit about the terrain around the camp and how to operate in it. Except the first group had gotten lost right away, in spite of its maps and instruments. That wouldn't have been all that bad if they'd just chosen a more or less suitable site, set up some kind of position, and waited to ambush the second team when it came to find them. No such chance. Instead, Roadkill had gotten into a discussion with Brick about which way they were originally supposed to go, and most of the rest of the squad had taken sides with one or the other. Meanwhile, the other squad, which admittedly had the somewhat tougher job of finding the first, got lost itself, even more thoroughly than the first. When Brandy had finally gotten annoyed and sent out a search party, she'd found the second team trudging through the desert in an almost perfect circle around the first party. In fact, the only thing both squads had done, according to orders, was to maintain comm silence so as not to alert the opponents of their position, and, since nobody had kept an eye on the emergency comm frequency, both groups were utterly unaware that Brandy had been trying to recall them for several hours before she'd given up and sent out the search party, which, to her utter annoyance, had promptly gotten itself lost. It had taken most of the afternoon to finally get everybody found and back on base, luckily with no injuries worse than sunburn. And all this while the captain was entertaining the AEIOU team, which was snooping around the base looking for reasons to find Omega Company guilty of environmental offenses, with Barky ready to attack suspected polluters, and, while trying to keep the AEIOU team from noticing the party of big-wig big-game hunters that had landed just south of camp and apparently insisted on instant VIP treatment. All this was enough to turn Brandy's mind, yet again, toward the prospect of an early retirement. And maybe, this time, Captain Jester wouldn't manage to sweet-talk her out of it. So Brandy wasn't really paying attention when an unfamiliar sofant in a Legion uniform came up to her, dropped a duffel bag, came to attention, and saluted.
"Legionnaire Thumper reporting for duty, Sergeant," it said.
Brandy looked up from the training progress report she'd been in the process of deciding how to fill out. The new arrival was about a meter and a half tall, dressed in regulation Legion black, although a good bit less stylish than the standard Omega Mob version of the uniform, and had long ears, big eyes, and a ridiculously cute wiggly pink nose. She stared for a moment, then blurted out,
"Where the hell do you come from?"
The Legionnaire looked puzzled.
Do you mean originally, Sergeant, or just now?
Its voice was high and squeaky, though not unpleasant, and it didn't use a translator. Brandy shook her head.
"Radicate that,"
she said. She thought back a second and retrieved the new Legionnaire's name from memory.
"Thumper, what I mean is, what are you doing here?
Nobody told us there were any new troops coming."
"Sergeant, as far as I know, I'm the only new member sent to this company," said Thumper. "I came with the hunting party that just landed. I understand they owed someone important a favor."
"Huh,"
said Brandy.
"And that meant giving you a ride. What makes you important enough to get a trip on a civilian space yacht?"
I think it's because I got in trouble with a general," said Thumper.
He went on to tell a complex but predictable story of showing up as buddies in basic training and being made the scapegoat for a practical joke on General Blitzkrieg. At the end, he said,
"But I think maybe somebody thinks I'm all right. After all, my drill instructor said Omega Company is really one of the best in the Legion."
"The best, Legionnaire,"
said Brandy proudly. She set her paperwork aside and stood up.
"You are now a member of the best company in the Space Legion, and you better not forget it. But why don't you pick up that bag and follow me? I know where there's a vacant bunk. Then we can start showing you how things work in Omega. We do things a little differently around here."
She stalked off toward an entrance to the modular base with the new recruit close behind her. Hope sprang eternal. Maybe this one would be able to go out in the desert without getting lost.
Sushi toyed with his drink, then said, "Have you ever seen written Chinese?"
"Can't say that I have, son," said Rev. "Thought that was some kind of food, to tell you the truth."
Sushi managed not to roll his eyes. "The Chinese were an old earth people who spoke like 7 or 8 different languages," he said. "Mandarin, Cantonese, a bunch of others you don't need to know the names of."
"Why not?" said Duop with an evil grin.
"I bet you don't even know them all."
Sushi shot Duop a withering glance.
"Will you give a guy a break when he's trying to explain something? I think you've been hanging out with Mahatma."
"Hey, you know me, Sush," said Duop, "ever eager for knowledge."
"Yeah, because you've got none of it to spare," answered Sushi.
"All right, fellows, you're straying from the point," said Rev, raising a palm to stop them. "What were you saying, Sushi?"
"Anyhow, they spoke all these languages, and speaking one didn't give you more than a guess at understanding the others, but they were all written the same way. The written symbols represented the meaning of the words, not their sound. So a Mandarin speaker could pretty much read a document written by a Cantonese speaker, even if he couldn't understand the spoken language. It's sort of the opposite of the old-time European languages, where a reader could get a rough idea how a message in another language would sound, even if he didn't know what it means."
"Weird," said Duop. "Why'd they do a stupid thing like that, Sush?"
"Actually, it's not that stupid if you have a big empire with several different spoken languages," said Sushi, shrugging. "That gives you 2 choices. Either make everybody learn 1 common spoken language, the way the Romans did, or have 1 common written language, the Chinese way."
"You left one out," said Duop. "Auto-translators. You don't even need to have the same kind of ears for them to work."
"Sure, except the ancient Romans and Chinese didn't have auto-translators," said Sushi.
"You're jiving me, Sush," said Duop. "The Romans had everything, man. They were like Italians, only with a better army and space force."
Sushi rolled his eyes.
"I hate to tell you this, but the Romans didn't have a space force either."
"What?"
Duop's mouth fell open.
"Fangool, Sush. You can't tell me that shit with a straight face."
Rev raised his hands.
"Gentlemen, gentlemen," he said in a calming tone of voice. "We're straying off the point again. Sushi, you were telling us about how the Zenobians write, weren't you? I'd surely like to hear more about that."
"All right, here's the deal," said Sushi. "From what Qual said, it seems as if the Zenobians learned to read before they learned to speak. They're descended from predators. Well, in a sense, they still are predators. So the young ones depend on their vision more than most other Sophonts. Well, maybe the Gambolts would be similar. I don't know much about their language either, except the translator works for them."
"All right," said Rev. "So the Zenobians learned to read first. I reckon that would mean the written language ought to be pretty easy to understand, then."
"You'd think so," said Sushi, nodding. He took another pull on his beer. "But that brings me back to Chinese. I've heard people say that Chinese is actually very easy to read,
that all you have to do is look at the writing as pictures, and when you see what the pictures are, you know what the writing says.
Why, that's perfect, said Rev. So we ought to be able to read Zenobian even without a translator.
Yeah, sounds great, doesn't it? Said Sushi. Except it doesn't work quite that way. The pictures are too sketchy. Four lines sort of in a box might be a house or a dog.
Sounds like they couldn't draw very good, said Duop. Hell, even I can draw a house and a dog so they look different, and I ain't no Michelangelo.
Michelangelo? Who's that? Said Rev.
Italian artist. Best there was, said Duop. He laid on his back for 25 years painting fiascos on the ceiling of some big church.
Whatever else Duop might have had to say about Michelangelo, he was prevented by Sushi spraying a fine mist of beer out of his mouth as he fell out of his seat, laughing uncontrollably.
Chapter 10 Journal Number 703
Taking the visiting AEIOU inspectors on a tour of the Legion base was an operation that required a great deal of delicacy. My employer took every effort to ensure that the visitors were shown everything that might show the company in the greenest possible light, and as little as possible that might reflect discredit upon its environmental practices. After letting Lieutenant Rembrandt steer the inspectors through the less sensitive areas of the compound, the captain himself joined them to show off the more highly technological departments. This was where, in his opinion, his influx of his own funds had had the greatest effect in improving the company's performance. He didn't necessarily reckon on the inspectors believing otherwise.
"And this is our comm center," said Fool, showing the AEIOU inspection team through the doorway. "All official communications and most unofficial ones come through here."
"How much energy does it use?"
asked Inspector Slurry, eyeing the large panel of readouts above Mother's console.
"Less than you'd think," said Fool. "In a military field base, we have to be prepared to operate in emergency conditions. One of the first things an attacker is going to try to hit is the power supply. So in a pinch, we have to be able to run our entire system on the power we can produce ourselves. That puts the premium on efficiency."
"Efficiency is a relative term," said Inspector Gardner. "It tends to vary depending on what the person using the word is trying to sell you. Just how much power do these systems use in a normal day's activities?"
Fool paused a second before answering. "Our exact power requirements are classified, but I think it's safe enough to tell you that we can run the entire base indefinitely on solar energy, which, of course, there's plenty of out here in the desert, and there are backup systems in case we get a run of bad weather, natural or otherwise. Again, you'll have to pardon me for not giving details."
"Well, solar is acceptably green for the most part," said Chief Inspector Sneef. "I do want to find out about these backup systems, though. I'll have you know that I've made a study of most of the ways one can generate and store power, and the majority of them are very suspect environmentally. I would hate to think..."
Whatever Sneef would have hated to think, her revelation was interrupted by a loud exclamation from Barky, the environmental dog, who had wandered through the comm center, sniffing the equipment and eyeing the personnel, and had finally found his way to the door of the officer's lounge. There, he had halted, staring inside the door and growling, which no one had quite noticed until he let loose with a series of loud barks.
"What in space?" said Fool. He strode over to the door and looked inside to see what had caused the dog's reaction. There, to his surprise, stood Tuscanini on top of a chair, his head scraping the ceiling. The Voltron was scowling down its long snout at the environmental dog.
"Uh-oh," said Fool. "Tell famous doggy would be most healthy for him to stay distant,"
said Tuscanini calmly, but emphatically.
"I no want to be hurting little earth animal, but I tell you now, doggy tries to bite, Tuscanini doing what he needing to do."
"Barky," said Inspector Gardner.
"Come on, fella, leave the nice sofont alone. He can't help it if he smells."
"Tuscanini no smell," said the Voltron. "Doggy smell, Tuscanini stink."
"Now, let's not take things too literally," said Fool, stepping gingerly between Tuscanini and Barky, now apparently pacified. Inspector Gardner was down on one knee beside the dog, scratching him between the shoulder blades and holding lightly onto his collar.
"Would it be fair to say that Barky's nose is perhaps a little too sensitive, Inspector Sneef?"
The AEIOU inspector sniffed.
"Barky is a genetically enhanced ultra-canine, highly trained to discern the smells of pollution and other assaults on the environment.
If some of the sophonts in your company carry odors like those of common pollutants, it may be no surprise that he reacts to them with hostility. Would it be fair to say that perhaps some of your legionnaires need to bathe more frequently, Captain Jester?
Begging your pardon, Chief Inspector, I seriously doubt that is the problem, said Beaker. If I may be permitted to say so, I can testify, based on personal observation, that the bathing facilities on this post would be the pride of many private athletic clubs.
Maybe, said Inspector Slurry. Probably waste water, too.
I think I can respond to that, said Fool, grinning. This base module is about as water-efficient as you can contrive, Inspector. A military unit in an arid environment can't afford to take water for granted. We recover, reuse, recycle, and recondition every possible drop of water. In fact, about the only way we could do better would be to capture the perspiration of our legionnaires working outside the base. And if we really needed to do that, I suspect we could find a way to do it.
Undoubtedly by throwing even more money at it, said Sneef. Have you ever sat down and calculated how many resources your company requires to maintain this exorbitant lifestyle?
Oh, yes, said Fool. I think you'd find the figures very interesting. If you compare us to units of similar size on similar missions, you'll find that Omega Company actually has a significantly less negative impact on the environment than a typical military operation. Granted, I've solved a lot of our problems by spending money, but it's my money I'm spending, not the government's, and I make very sure I get what I'm paying for.
Never minding money, said Tuscanini. Why don't you taking Barky Dog away so Tuscanini can finish reading book? I'm halfway through Old Earth Classic and want to know how it comes out.
He pointed to a thick volume on the floor. The spine of the book displayed the curious word, Dahlgren.
Woof,
said Barky, the environmental dog, sniffing the book. But then Inspector Gardner clapped his hands, and a few moments later, the environmental dog and all the other visitors left the officer's lounge to Tuscanini. With a snort of relief, the Voltron stepped off the table and picked up his book. He wasn't quite sure where the story was leading, but on the whole, it wasn't any stranger than most of the other human literature he'd read, which, he thought as he settled down, wasn't saying very much. The Fat Chance Casino was crowded as Ernie made his way through the gaming rooms. No surprise there. According to the local newspaper, several large space liners had just made their regular stopovers at Lorelei, and the travel-weary passengers were eagerly getting what they'd come for. First-class dining, lavish entertainment, and high-stakes gambling. The sight of all the expensively dressed suckers with fat credit accounts made Ernie's mouth water. It was every grifter's dream, and there were plenty of grifters willing to take advantage of it. Except in the Fat Chance Casino, where Captain Jester had ordered his security forces to clamp down on anything that might cut into the player's enjoyment or the house's percentage. He stopped at the bar and ordered a drink, a tall glass of quinine water with a twist of lime. No alcohol tonight. That had been another of his promises to Lola. Instead, he'd brought along an aroma cap, a tiny capsule filled with an aromatic oil that, rubbed on the skin, conveyed the exact odor of an expensive brand of imported gin. If the marks or casino security thought he'd been drinking heavily, they were likely to underestimate him. Better yet, as long as he stuck to Aldebaran Amber Gin, Ernie had a fair chance of convincing Lola that he'd been using the aroma cap instead of knocking back a few G&Ts while he was supposed to be working. But this time, Ernie had promised Lola to stay straight. More importantly, he'd promised not to do anything that might draw the attention of security, either the casinos or Victor Fool's very professional bodyguard. That meant resisting the temptation to pocket any loose chains that might be lying around, such as waiters' uncollected tips or customers' unattended handbags. And it meant not carrying any of a number of devices meant to increase the odds in his favor, devices generally frowned upon by both the casinos and by those players who were naive enough to expect that everyone else in the game was playing by the rules. Especially in the Fat Chance, the ownership took exception to such devices, and its guards seemed to have a better-than-average record at spotting them in use. In most places, he'd have taken his chances and figured on tipping the security guards to turn a blind eye. But the Fat Chance Casino's policy was to expel any cheaters it caught, not just from the casino, but from Lorelei itself, and its guards were apparently tip-proof. If Ernie and Lola were identified as cheats, their chances of completing the mission that brought them here shrank very close to zero, as did their chances of convincing a certain Mr. V to let them keep breathing. That was good enough to convince Ernie to keep his hands to himself and leave his educated dice at home. His specific mission tonight was to find either of the fools, Willard, a.k.a. Captain Jester, or his father Victor. In principle, that was a no-brainer. He knew what both men looked like and had a fair idea where, in the public parts of the casino, they might be found this time of day. In practice, as his previous experience with the younger fool had taught him, the job was far from easy. On their previous visit to Lorelei, Ernie and Lola had laid a subtle trap to kidnap the captain of Omega Company, and on the spaceliner away from Lorelei Station, found themselves in custody of an andromatic robot whose features were a dead ringer for Captain Jesters. The situation had fallen entirely apart when the robot had commandeered an escape pod and left the spaceliner entirely. Luckily, nobody on board the ship had managed to connect them to the incident, or else, in addition to their other troubles, they might now be trying to figure out how to come up with the replacement value of a deep space escape pod. Ernie had no idea whether the robot had been recovered or replaced. Certainly the fools could afford to do either. But barring information to the contrary, he and Lola agreed that any fool they encountered had to be considered a possible robot. Since their contract had said nothing about robots, since, in fact, Mr. V had been emphatically uninterested in hearing about their misadventures, the two kidnappers needed to be sure they were getting the real thing. And with a high-priced bodyguard standing nearby, an experimental poke or pinch to determine the subject's reaction would not be a good idea. Ernie drifted nonchalantly through the casino, stopping to look at the play at a table here or there, occasionally placing a small bet on a whim. If anyone were watching, they were likely to check him off as a bored dilettante with no fixed purpose. But he gradually made his way toward the higher-priced rooms, where his quarry was likely to be playing or watching the action. What would happen when he found one of the fools remained to be seen? But he'd think of something, he was sure. He could always think of something.
"Well, I believe you've seen our whole camp," Fool said to the AEIOU inspectors. "I can see it's getting close to dinner time. Could I persuade you to stay for a taste of Omega Company's cooking? I think Sergeant Eskrima is as fine a chef as you'll find in this arm of the galaxy."
"Is the food organic?" asked Slurry, a dubious expression on his face. "We absolutely insist on that."
"I believe you can take it for granted that Sergeant Eskrima's offerings fulfill that requirement," said Beaker, his chin inching upward. "In fact, it is all but impossible to obtain nutrition from inorganic substances."
"The nanoids seem to do just fine with sand," said Fool, grinning. "But I think you're missing the point, Beaks." He turned back to the AEIOU team. "In fact, Eskrima insists on only the freshest and purest ingredients. I ought to know, since I'm the one paying for them. And he prides himself on being able to supply a satisfying meal to anyone who walks into the mess hall. At the moment, he's responsible for feeding members of at least 5 different species, and I don't know how many ethnicities, so I'm sure you'll find a wide selection of dishes to meet your requirements. Unless you insist on your food being bland or overcooked, in which case he'll probably come after you with a red-hot skewer. Would you like to join us?"
Inspector Gardner chuckled.
"I've been eating camp food for long enough that I'm tempted to take you up on it, unless your chef's an even worse terror than you say."
"You may be certain he's a terror, sir," said Beaker. "But I'd advise you to take up the captain's invitation nonetheless. The food is the best on the planet."
"Given the alternatives, I'd be very surprised if it weren't," said Gardner. "Even so, I'd love to join you, but I can only speak for myself. Chief, do you think we can eat here, or do we need to go back to our own camp?"
"Eating here would help conserve our own food supplies," added Slurry. "And it would give us a chance to evaluate the Legion's energy efficiency and waste management procedures."
"You shouldn't judge the Legion as a whole by us," said Lieutenant Rembrandt earnestly. "To be as clean and green as we are, you have to have a CO who cares about something besides kowtowing to the top brass. Most Legion companies spend so much time trying to avoid getting on the wrong side of headquarters that they can barely achieve their basic mission, let alone worry about the environment."
"Thank you, Lieutenant," said Chief Inspector Sneef. "But I believe I'm going to make my own decision on this company's environmental practices rather than accept the testimony of an undoubtedly biased party. Granted, I haven't found any blatant destruction of vital habitats or flagrant pollution of the environment, so far. The lack of evidence doesn't mean this company isn't guilty."
"What a convenient system," said Beaker. "Guilty until proven innocent. It must save you ever so much trouble."
"We nearly destroyed old Earth by giving the anti-environment forces too many loopholes," retorted Sneef. "The AEIOU has sworn never to let that happen again."
"Perhaps you should consult the local inhabitants before you make your decision," said Rembrandt. "The captain has worked very closely with the Zenobians to minimize the impact of this base on their planet. If they're satisfied, why is it your concern?"
"Locals can be very short-sighted," said Slurry.
It's our business to think of the long term.
Well, at the moment, I'm not thinking any farther ahead than dinner, said Fool, stepping forward to cut off any reply from his officers. If you all want to join me, now's your chance, and I cannot only promise you the best food on the planet, but one of the best meals you'll ever eat.
Gardner and Slurry both looked at Sneef, but apprehension was clear on their faces as their chief wrinkled her brow, trying to decide. Some of the legionnaires who'd overheard the discussion shook their heads or grinned ruefully. Eskrima's cooking had spoiled them for the kind of rations the AEIOU contingent had undoubtedly brought with them to Zenobia. The inspectors would be sorry if they missed it, but they'd be even sorrier if they accepted the invitation and then had to go back to their own cooking. At last, Chief Inspector Sneef shrugged and said,
"Very well, Captain. We'll dine with you tonight. It's late enough that by the time we return to camp, we'd be behind schedule for our meal. I suppose we will simply have to trust this Legion cook to make us something moderately healthy and not too extravagant."
"I think you can trust Eskrima for that," said Fool, with a knowing smile.
"Come with me."
And he turned and led the AEIOU inspectors toward the mess hall. Mess Sergeant Eskrima, undisputed ruler of Omega Company's kitchens and dining hall, hadn't been told to expect company for dinner, but that didn't matter. Every meal that came out of his kitchen was a special occasion, as far as he was concerned, and when he learned that the visitors were humans, he shrugged. For someone who regularly cooked for Cynthians, Gambolts, and a Voltron, that was no challenge at all. Sure enough, the captain's guests had found plenty to put on their plates as they went through the line. One of the AEIOU inspectors, a severe-looking woman, restricted herself to plainly cooked vegetables and rice. Eskrima, watching from behind the counters, thought she could use a little fattening up, but kept his opinion to himself. If she didn't appreciate his sauces and meat dishes, she wasn't worth talking to anyway, he thought. As long as she didn't say anything, he'd leave her alone. The others took a wider sampling of the cuisine and seemed excited to find so many tasty choices of what they must have expected to be a typical military mess. That made Eskrima feel better. He always enjoyed surprising visitors who thought that institutional food was required by some cosmic law to consist of subpar ingredients, unimaginative recipes, and bad cookery. Even Barky, the environmental dog, was relatively easy to please. An interplanetary Tri-V star could have gotten away with being much more temperamental. Even ace reporter Jenny Higgins had been known to get picky about her dinner selection, but the legionnaires of Omega Company, at least the ones who dared get close to his teeth, oohed and aahed to see such a famous animal in their midst. And so, with a good dose of fan appreciation as appetizer, the ever-environmentally aware Barky settled right down with a medium-rare prime veggie rib and seemed as happy as a clam in unpolluted water. Eskrima grinned. Most cooks, even the specialists in vegetarian cuisine, had a tough time making veggie beef taste like anything but recycled cardboard, which it mostly was, and then only by disguising it with enough marinade and sauces to swamp a space liner. Only a genius like Eskrima could serve it up plain and make it not just edible, but delicious. He'd been more worried by another variation from the normal routine tonight, the unannounced arrival of a new legionnaire of a species not previously represented in Omega Company. Eskrima pulled down his trusty copy of The Practical Chef's Encyclopedia of Culinary Preferences and Nutritional Requirements of Sofants Around the Alliance, and looked up the entry on the new arrival. It'd be just his luck to be short of some non-synthesizable nutrient the Lepoids required, with no way to get it but express delivery at exorbitant prices. And since the entire expense would be to feed just one legionnaire, some bean counter in headquarters was likely to gripe at the expense. That was tough luck as far as Eskrima was concerned. They should have thought about that before they sent a Lepoid legionnaire to Zenobia. His job was to feed him, and screw anybody who didn't like the expense. But after flipping through several cross-references and charts of substitutions, scowling as he matched the names of the exotic ingredients with their common equivalents, Sergeant Eskrima sat back and smiled. Feeding the new guy was going to be a piece of cake, after all. Carrot cake, to be exact. Thumper's introduction to Omega Company was progressing at whirlwind speed. In the short time he'd been at the company's Zenobia base, he'd already met the first sergeant, who'd shown him to a comfortable barracks room and explained how Omega Company did things. He was going to be paired with one of the other legionnaires on base, not just as a roommate, but as a partner. This was one of Captain Jester's innovations, though Thumper didn't quite understand the reason for it. But eventually he'd get it, he knew. He was a smart Lepoid, and had the grades in school to prove it. Things hadn't gone quite so well in basic training, but that had been his first exposure to mass human psychology. Now he had a better idea what was going on,
Or so he thought.
The mess hall was open for the evening meal beginning at 1700 hours, the same as in basic. Here, though, the legionnaires apparently had the option of going to eat at any time between then and 2030, instead of being assigned a set, and usually too short, time slot, during which they had to report for their meal. Having had his last meal just before the human hunter's shuttle landed on Zenobia, Thumper was starved. He finished stowing his gear, washed his paws, and combed his whiskers, and stepped out into the corridor, hoping the mess hall was close by and easy to find. It was. At the end of the short corridor leading to his barracks room, Thumper turned left and almost immediately saw the double doors of the mess hall in front of him. There was a small group of legionnaires standing around chatting just outside the doors, while a stream of their comrades walked through. Not really knowing anyone yet, Thumper stepped past them and took a tray. He was unavoidably conscious that the conversation in the group behind him had stopped just after he had passed, then resumed in a lower tone. It didn't take a genius to figure out what had caused it. New guy, they were undoubtedly saying. New guy. Well, he was a new guy, here at least. Before long, he'd get a chance to show them just what kind of guy he was, and if he'd learned anything from his last talk with Sergeant Pitbull, he thought they'd be glad to have him on board. Meanwhile, his stomach reminded him, he hadn't eaten in hours. There was a food service line ahead of him with absolutely wonderful aromas wafting out to the nostrils of the waiting legionnaires. Thumper stepped into line and took one of the trays, which, he was surprised to see, was not the ugly standard-issue plastic that everyone in Legion Basic had used. Instead, these trays came in a variety of pastel shades with geometrical designs that might actually enhance the user's enjoyment of eating. Even more surprising, they all managed to be attractively clean, rather than unappealingly sterile. Thumper hadn't been in the Legion very long, but he already knew enough to recognize that this wasn't typical of mess halls. He stepped into line behind a tall legionnaire. Almost all of them were a lot taller than he was, but he was used to that, too, and peered over the edge of the counter at the food. There was a selection of raw vegetables, the kind the humans called salad. He took a large helping of that, and an equal amount of cooked greens, which, for the first time since he joined the Legion, weren't boiled beyond recognition. He wondered how Omega Company got enough fresh vegetables to supply the mess hall. He hadn't noticed a garden patch on his way to the base, but that didn't mean there wasn't one away from the route he'd traveled. It was just a real treat to see fresh veggies once again. It almost felt like home. Best of all, there was no sergeant standing there to tell him what to take or how much, either. Omega Company apparently let its legionnaires eat whatever they wanted. That was a really trif idea, thought Thumper. He couldn't remember a time when there wasn't somebody telling him what to eat, beginning with his mother. He was ready for a change. He looked around the room for a place to sit. He'd only met a couple of members of the company so far, so he had nobody in particular to look for. Plenty of tables had empty seats, so he had his choice of dinner companions. Then, he caught a whiff of something he hadn't in his fondest dreams expected to find this far away from home. Carrot cake, his favorite dessert. Thumper followed the delicious aroma to its source, a serving station piled high with desserts of all kinds. He recognized some of them as distant relations of the offerings in the mess hall back in basic training, obviously far more palatable, even to his non-human taste buds. But it was the carrot cake that he craved that promised his taste buds all the delights of home. He was so intrigued by the aroma that he didn't even notice when the trouble started.
"Well, boys, it looks like we're not making a whole heap of progress with this," said Rev, setting down his glass. "I reckon we ought to call a halt and go get some food in our bellies."
Duop knocked back a half-full glass of beer and set it down with a wistful look.
"If you say so, man," he said.
"Hey, I was just getting started, but a little chow don't sound so bad when you come right down to it."
Sushi, who had had only one drink, stood up and said,
"I'd even settle for a big chow, but I don't think Eskrima cooks that recipe. I suspect some of the guys would vote to put Barky in the stew pot, though."
"Now, now, son," said Rev. "The king wouldn't like to hear you talk that way about a fellow star, especially not a dog. You talk nice about Barky here. That little old pup's a surefire hit any time he's on a vid screen."
"Star or no star, he better stay away from me," said Duop. "Come on, if we're going to stand around and jabber, I'm getting me another brew."
"Hey, I've been already," said Sushi, punching Duop in the shoulder. "Come on, let's go find out what Eskrima's cooking."
The three of them entered the dining hall together, took trays and made their selections. Reb and Sushi went for chicken, There was a choice of southern fried or curried, with rice, while Duop loaded up his plate with butterfly pasta in a rich Alfredo sauce and crisp broccoli tips. The trio were on their way to the drink station when the trouble started. Sushi was the first to notice anything out of the ordinary.
"Who's the new guy over there?"
he asked, pointing to the dessert line. The others turned their heads to see what he was talking about. There was a small figure in a regulation Legion jumpsuit, considerably less dashing than the special uniform Captain Jester had ordered for Omega Company to wear. Sushi just barely had time to notice that the new company member, he assumed that was what the newcomer had to be, had long floppy ears, when a familiar sound came from behind them.
"Woof, woof,"
said Barky, the environmental dog, baring his fangs and charging full speed in the direction of a little legionnaire. Chief Inspector Sneef leapt up and called out,
"Barky, sit! Bad dog, sit!"
But nobody, least of all the environmental dog, was paying much attention to her at this point. The three legionnaires made an altogether praiseworthy effort to get out of the dog's way, but, inhabited by full trays of food, they were nowhere near nimble enough. As Barky's well-fed bulk crashed into his shins, Duop's tray tilted, then tipped directly over, dumping a plateful of steaming hot pasta with Alfredo sauce on his legs, the floor, and onto Barky's bare back. That set off a chorus of woeful howls from Duop and Barky both. Barky spun around to find whoever was attacking him, but the wet floor offered no traction, and so the famous environmental dog slid full speed into Sushi's legs. That, inevitably, sent Sushi tumbling into Rev, and both men went down in a heap. At the same time, their trays hit the floor, scattering chicken and rice in all directions. There were gasps and shouts from those within range of the flying food, and all over the mess hall, heads turned to see what the disturbance was about. They hadn't missed anything to speak of. The chain reaction was just beginning to pick up momentum. Chocolate Harry, going back to the main serving line for seconds, turned his head to look at what was happening behind him and, inevitably, put his foot in exactly the wrong place, on a stray chicken leg, and went down with a basso profundo shout of, "Goddamn son of a bitch!" in an avalanche of table scraps, dishes, and cutlery. One of his forks bounced twice, flipped over 1.5 times, and arrived prongs first in the close vicinity of Barky's tail, sending the galaxy-wide star environmental dog off yelping in the direction of the dessert stand, where Thumper still stood, surveying the catastrophe unfolding around him with eyes growing steadily wider. One look at Barky was enough to convince Thumper that he had come to the wrong place at the wrong time. With the finely honed reflexes of a recent graduate of Legion basic training, Thumper dropped his own tray and took off for the nearest cover, as if his life depended on it. Unfortunately, Barky's canine instincts were aroused by the sight of something running, and he redoubled his speed in an attempt to catch the fleeing lepoid. Meanwhile, an infuriated Chocolate Harry had begun gathering up various articles from the floor around him and throwing them, with an obligato of curses truly worthy of a veteran Legion sergeant, in the general direction of the environmental dog. Unfortunately, Harry's aim was about what one would expect of a supply sergeant who had moved the trash basket next to his desk so as to avoid bending over to pick up the paper wads that missed their target. One of his hastily flung chicken bones caught Duop square in the chest. Harry couldn't have picked a worse target on purpose. Never one to back down from a perceived challenge, Duop scooped up a handful of pasta with Alfredo sauce and fired it back at Chocolate Harry. Duop had no better aim than Harry. His improvised missile went far and wide, hitting Double X, who had just turned to see what was happening, full in the face. The legionnaire dropped his tray and fell backwards into the main food station, knocking it over and scattering the contents across the floor and hitting, among others, Super Nat, who had been right behind Double X. That was the final spark to set off an explosion. Super Nat snatched up a boiled potato and fired it off. The spud hit Duop directly in the snoot. Temporarily blinded, Duop stepped on another gob of Alfredo sauce and fell back on top of Rev, who had almost managed to get up on all fours. The pair went down with an impressive splash in the spilled pasta, but not before Duop managed to fire off an unaimed breast of chicken that landed on a nearby table, knocking a pitcher of orange juice onto the laps of Roadkill, Street, and two of the Gambles. Almost immediately, food was flying in every direction. Half of Omega Mob enthusiastically joined in, and the other half broke for the exits. Meanwhile, Thumper and Barky were racing around the mess hall as if their lives depended on it, with the AEIOU inspectors following in a dogged attempt to prevent their intergalactic media star from injuring himself. Some of the legionnaires, whether angered at the inspector's perceived interference in their operation or simply aroused by the challenge of moving targets, concentrated their fire on the AEIOU team,